Hey, welcome to another episode of Mind Your Loaf, a podcast about taking action on our mental health. I'm here with my co-host, Mar.
Hi.
Yeah, and the team at Irish Mental Health Charity TurnToMe.ie, who besides helping us with this podcast, provide professional mental health support online, which is free to everyone in Ireland. This is a new episode, isn't it, Mar?
Yes, it is.
Now, this episode is going to be about turning your life around.
Yeah, I'm really actually looking forward to this.
Yeah, well, I tell you, I am as well, because the man I've brought in is a man called Willa White. And I'll just introduce you, Willie. So just wait a second, right? So Willa White now is he's a scaffolder. Willa White is a comedian, like brilliant comedian, and he is just won Best Actor at the Dublin Fringe Awards, wasn't it, Will? In 2019.
I'm an award-winning actor.
Really?
Yeah. So he's an award-winning actor, and he's a comedian and a scaffolder, and no better man to come in and talk about turn your life around, because I know Willie about 15 years now. He's a great friend of mine, Willie.
Yeah.
Now, I'll have to say, and I'm going to put this in as well, when you separate, or you know what I mean, when you separate from your wife and all this kind of stuff, mm-hmm. it's kind of weird in Ireland. Like, people go one way or the other way, and Willie never left my side.
Thanks,
Willie.
You're very, very welcome, Jason. That's what friends are for.
Yeah, so he's a great friend of mine. And I when someone said to me, like, we want to do an episode and turn your life around, I don't know anybody mm-hmm. else in the world. And I've gigged everywhere and anywhere that someone has, like, turned their life around. I mean, that Willie over there should literally be, like, not alive sitting in front of us.
It's a real weird name over there.
Yeah, yeah. Over there.
I'm from a big family. Yeah. The over there's.
So he's
Willie over there.
Like, he's sitting there. He's like, the play, the acting, never. But I mean, because we're going to be talking about turning your life around, Will, I mean, do you want to start back where you're from and, like, how it all start? Like, what, like, how you, I mean, you're, because I remember saying, okay, this, we'll not talk over Willie now again, but I'm going to say, I'm from Ballantyre, Willie is from Ballymun. The thing I got into trouble for was doing a knick-knack on the door, and I told that to Willie, and he told me his life, and I went, ah, yeah, right, okay.
We used to take people's doors. Jason used to knock on them.
So, start wherever you want to start, like, just about how your life developed.
I suppose I'll start Jesus from the beginning and tell you a bit about me and where I'm from and what it was like growing up. I come from a very small family. I'm the tallest. I'm 5'7". And no, it was just myself, my sister, and my mother and father growing up. And we came from Ballymun. I was born the south side and moved to Ballymun at a very, very young age. And came from a dysfunctional family. My mother and father liked to have a drink, and it's crazy because from the outside we looked very, very normal. Like, everything looked yeah. great. Like, we materialistic grown up, myself and my sister, we had everything, you know. My dad had a good job. He worked for Post and Telegraphs at the time, which, you know, then turned into Telecom Éireann and Aircom, and now it's Air. And my mother worked in the rag trade, as she called it. She worked in clothing factories and stuff. So there was good money coming into the house. And
where are you in Ballymun? Were you in the houses or the
No, we were in the flats. We were flats. It's mad because when we moved, we moved to Ballymun first, we moved into 15 Shangan Avenue, which were the four stories. Do you know? Right. So he used to come out in the morning and go, sturdy, 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 sturdy. So that was four stories. The people that lived in the 15 stories never got out of the house. So we lived there. We moved to 15 Shangan Avenue. And my sister Susan wasn't well, me oldest sister. And so they moved back into Crampton Buildings. And Crampton Buildings, if you don't know, is in Temple Bar. It's a little set of tenement flats in the heart.
I know them. They're gorgeous.
So my sister wasn't well, and my ma's sister was a ghost in 15 Shangan Avenue, and he used to flush the chain during the night in the toilet. And I says, you know, but she was dead serious. There was a ghost. So when we went back to Crampton Buildings, and me dad kind of says, that was mad. There was hot water out there in central heating, and look where we are. They asked the council again, could they go back? And we moved into 16 Shangan Avenue, which was next door, which was grand because there was no ghost there and there was no chains being flushed or anything like that. So that's where I kind of grew up. We lived on the fourth floor. On the top floor, there was 8 flats in each block. So we were the second lift shaft. And it was mad growing up. It was crazy. And I was telling a fella the other day that he couldn't believe it. We'd one public telephone box between the 8 stories and the 4 stories. Jeez. And there was always someone who manned it. So when the phone rang, they'd say, will you go and get the Flynn's out on number 56?
Really?
I swear to God, right?
So he'd year, run. What year are you talking there?
I'm going back to the 70s, like.
Yeah.
Between, well, I was born in 71, so 71 to say 82, there was always so, and it was great. It was a great number if you were at the phone box, because you always got temptings or 20 pence for going and getting the person to come down to the phone, like, you know? Yeah. And my dad worked in Post and Telegraph, so we never had a phone. I said it probably could have been worse if we worked for the ESB and we'd no fucking electricity. Like, yeah. So we were kind of lucky in one sense. But it was mad. Growing up, it was my childhood was it was kind of bittersweet. It would be the best way to describe it. During the day, I used to get out of the house and run wild, so to speak. There was horses and there was always stuff to do because there was no phones back then, you know. So you were kind of...
How old were you then?
I remember my childhood from about I started taking drugs when I was about 7 or 8 years
really?
Of age. Like, I started sniffing glue and I started taking solvents, you know, and it was great. I have to say, it was brilliant, like, because you hear that saying of people saying, you know, it was out of my head. And for the stuff that was going on home, my father was very violent towards my mother, so it was great. When I took drugs actually took me away from what was going on at home.
You could escape.
So it was like, you hear people saying I was out of my head, and that's why I took drugs, was actually to get out of my head from what was going on.
And you were like 7, 8 years of age sniffing glue.
Yeah, sniffing glue and taking solvents, you know, lighter fuel or anything.
And was it like there was a whole group of you doing that?
Yeah, there was a few of us doing it.
Kids that would have given that to you? Or
no, we seen the older people doing it and all the lads doing it and we just tried it. So it was, you know, and there was lots of lads that done it with me that never kind of ended up on the road that I ended up on. I think from a very early age, I just kind of had that thing in me that I just, if someone... you know, drank 4 cans of beer, I wanted to drink 6 cans of beer. I remember going away with the under-11s football team and bringing a bottle of Old Cellar sherry with me and drinking the whole bottle, like, you know, when I was a kid. Yeah, it was...
So were you getting sick and falling around?
Yeah, I was in a bundle and I haven't drank sherry since, like, you know...
Since I was 11.
Old Cellar, since I was 11,
So you're now on a mental road. Like, that
is...
Anybody listening or going, 11... Age, like,
I know. I look at my daughter and she's 12 years of age and I just can't imagine, you know, her living the life that I lived when I was a young child. So it was...
And do you think it's because of where you were living? Do you know what I mean?
No.
I
suppose the environment had a little bit to do with it. But I mean,
another thing is, were a lot of your mates going through the same thing? Did you have like same parents that were like...
Some of them did have stuff like that. But I mean, they never ended up where I ended up. And there was a lot of kids. I just kind of find with addiction, from my addiction, is that it was never where I was from, or I was the problem, you know. Look, I know lots of people that grew up in great families and with, you know, with great parents and that. I was starved of love and affection as a child. Like, my dad was very violent towards me and my sister, and we just didn't get, you know, we weren't hugged and there was none of that type of stuff, you know. We didn't know any of that. And when I look back later on in life, I realise that from where my father came from, and when I done a bit of homework on his father and seeing the type of person that his father was, that he actually done a really, really good job of me and my sister, as much as I thought it was a disaster at the time. It really wasn't, you know.
Did he come from the same type of background?
He came from a worse background. Right. There was 16 kids in my dad's family. Like, there was 10 boys and 6 girls. And they'd nothing. Like, I was talking to my uncles about stuff that happened years ago, and my dad's brother, Tommy, there's only 3 of them left out of 16 now. Like, my own father passed away in 2016. And his brother, Tommy, that he never seen toilet roll till he went to live in London in 1954. He says they ate out of the bins in the corporation fruit markets. Jeez. That they hadn't got. They literally hadn't. It's like that thing, they were piss poor. They hadn't got a pot to piss in. Like,
so your dad had no love or empathy shown to him either.
My grandfather, without going in depth to him, was a fucking animal by all accounts. And I actually don't really feel bad about saying that. I don't know why they named me after him. I got named after him for a man that was they were actually going to call me Jason, funny enough. My mum was going to call me Jason.
Lovely,
and my granddad died, and I got named after a fucking monster. Right. And I don't mind saying that. And if any of my family is listen to the podcast and that, you know, they'll kind of understand what I'm talking about. So, yeah, when I look back at where my dad came from, and there was no love and affection in his house. So, you know, in some way, we were probably kind of bought, you know, materialistic, you know, I'd a rally boner and I'd nice clothes and, you know, it was a very...
See, a lot of people think is listening as well go, you're from Ballymun, so you must be just taking drugs because you're from there.
No.
But I love your point of saying that you could be from anywhere. The situation you got into is because you weren't being given the love.
Yeah, well,
I mean, addiction doesn't care where you're from, who you are, what religion you are, what colour you are. I mean, you look at some of the people through history, famous people that have ended up addicted to drugs and ended up dying from drugs. It was really nothing to do with their childhood. Like, you know, they got famous and they got a shitload of money and they didn't know how to handle it or they didn't know how to deal with it. And, and some of them just ended up dead. So
I was just going to say, you're 11 and 12, right? You're on glue and is it aerosol as well?
Yeah,
and all that?
Lighter fluid.
Whatever.
Yeah, you put it in between your teeth and you inhale it.
Which is mad because I'm the same age as you. At the exact same time, I was just in a field playing football.
It's crazy because I know when I actually think about it, it is actually really sad when I look back at my life and I look at the life that I've had compared to where I am now. It's really upsetting for me even sometimes, you know.
Because you probably feel sorry for that little kid.
Yeah, of course I do. Yeah, I really, really do.
If you could hold him now and just go, what are you doing?
And it's mad because I've got two kids now and I've got a granddaughter, I'm a granddad, like, and I made sure that when my kids were born that they were smothered with love and they were smothered with affection.
Yeah.
And they grew up in a completely different way to the way I grew up. I mean, my dad drank and my dad smoked, like, and... Like, when my kids were born, they've never seen me drunk because I don't drink. They've never seen me on drugs because I don't take drugs anymore. And, you know, so it's the completely, I've completely smashed the chain, so to speak.
Yeah.
In my family, my dad never owned his own house. And I'm not saying that, you know, material things in life, as I'm very, very aware of, and I'm sure Jason is very aware of, don't mean nothing if you don't feel good inside.
Yeah.
Like, you know, like, nothing is going to fix me but me. And I'm very, very aware of that.
How did you, like, what you're talking about is this intergenerational repeating of a pattern all the time. And then it gets to you and you've smashed these chains. What about you enabled you to smash those chains?
Oh, it was a long, long journey after that, Mar. Look, I progressed all the way kind of up the ranks and I left school uneducated. I done my intercert. Me and my mate Martin Boylan went back to the gaff. We bleached the two exam results. We wrote in our own exam results because it was printed in pen. And my dad thought I was fucking Einstein when I gave him the results.
I like it.
And then the letter came to the door saying that they wanted to see me mother and father. I mean, mother and father probably thought I was getting an award for all them A's and B's. And then they basically got up and told them I was the fucking class clown and that I got nothing. I didn't even pass English. Like,
yeah.
And my dad fucking went to town on me, like, really? It was murder. But
so at that stage now, Will, like, have you progressed now to other drugs?
Yeah, so I'm drinking and smoking weed at this stage, and I'm taking tablets every now and again, you know, just like Valium and that. And then I went to go into the senior school, and Mr. Colryan said I wasn't coming into the school. He says, no. He says, we heard about you in the comprehensive and you're not coming in here. You might have broke your mother's heart, he says, but you're not going to fucking break mine. So I never got in.
Isn't that terrible?
Yeah.
Because obviously if that was a headmaster of a school and seen a child now like that, they'd help you.
Yeah, yeah.
And they'd go, my God, are you okay? Let's try and sort this out. But in those days, it was like, don't come in here. Because he's blaming you.
Yeah. Blaming you, yeah. That's
I was basically drowning and I was getting my hands into the boat and he was banging them off the fucking oar. Like,
and was there part of you that really wanted to get to school?
I wanted to go to the senior side. I didn't know what I wanted to do in life. I was just kind of at that age where I'd no ambitions. I'd no, you know, I didn't, you know, like a lot of young people is kind of structured when they finish, you know, the first part of second, like, third year, they kind of go, yeah, well, I'll go on, maybe I'll be a plumber or I'll be, I didn't know what I wanted to do, like, you know, I really didn't. I always worked from a very young age. Even like when I was, you know, 11, I sold the papers and I, you know, done fruit and veg and done the milk and anything to kind of make a few quid. My dad was always a grafter. He always worked, like, you know, so I kind of had that in me. And I grew up, the one thing that my mother and father gave me were really good ethics. Like, I really like nice manners and I'm very courteous and I always helped. Even though I was I was brought up as a good person.
But isn't that mad, though? Because people listening are going, like, because your mum and dad were abusive and drinking and whatever, and then you still have sympathy and empathy for you. You still have this crazy, weird kind of like for them.
You're able to
acknowledge what they gave you as well as what they didn't give you, in a way.
That was it. I went to live in London then when I was 16 years of age. When I didn't get into school, my mate was living in London. There was a few lads in London, a Manor House, and I went to live in London then. And I remember my sister...
At 16,
my sister gave me a crash course on how to earn and cook over about a week. And off I went.
Now, she was lovely to you, wasn't she?
Susan was great. She was brilliant. And so I went to live in London. And when I went to live in London, it was a great time to live in London because the rave scene was only coming in. I was over there like 1988, 89. So all the years was in and all that. So it was like, you know, it was like I fucking went to Disneyland or something like that. Do you know what I mean? And all the hugs that I never got off my mother and father.
Really?
I used to be at the raves, everyone used to be hugging me and I was like, fuck off, hugging me.
And actually, were you an affectionate person?
Yes, I was.
Even back then?
Do you know what? I am a big teddy bear. Like, people might look at me and go, you know, and even by the way that I talk, I don't like confrontation. I don't like violence. I've had times in my life where, I've had to, you know, step up for myself but I would avoid trouble. If we can avoid trouble, I will avoid trouble.
Yeah.
I hate bullies. I used to see kids getting bullied in school and I used to help them and I just haven't got that side in me where I don't like seeing kids as targets and I don't like seeing people being singled out and picked out, you know. So I kind of hadn't got that. So I went to live in London and it was...
Where are you living now? Are you in a squat or a house?
I was in a squat in Manor House in a place called Woodbury Downs Manor House.
And I know the way, you see, you speak to me about this and you go, I was in a squat and you go, anyway,
mad because
in my head, I'm thinking, it's a derelict house with sleeping bags and you've broken into that. And that's what a squat is.
And most of them in the house were all on the run from Dublin for
really?
Stuff that they're doing, yeah. And there was lads.
So
that
now
was
you're
on,
in with lunatics now.
Yeah, yeah. But I knew still at that time like that I didn't fit in with these people, but it was just somewhere to stay.
Yeah.
You know? Two of them died. Rusty died. He was a bricklayer from Ballymun and he was found dead in the toilets in somewhere in King's Cross.
Is that an overdose or?
Yeah, and Goffer died. I come home one night and Goffer was lying outside on the ground. He died. He wasn't dead at the time, but he died as well. So I knew the dangers of drugs and there was drugs in there. In the house, but I got a job then. I worked in a butcher shop. I got a job in a paint factory first, and I went in one morning because you could smoke on the buses over there, and I used to be smoking weed. But they had a forklift, so when you sat in the forklift, it was a side loading forklift, so the forks was that way, and you'd sit like this. But when you turned right, the forklift turned left. When you turned left, the forklift turned right.
Here.
Yeah.
Now, if you're at the smoking two joints on the way into work, what's left is right. So I had a big pallet of paint one morning. I'll never forget it. It was called Watco Sales Limited in Hackney Wick. And your man goes, yeah, mate, bring that out. Take it, put it on the lorry. And I was like, yeah, no problem, pal. And I went to go out to turn right and I bleed and turned the forklift right and I went left and the whole pallet of paint went all up. I just jumped out of the forklift and ran up the road. That was it. I just left it because sure, you couldn't contact me. I had no phone.
Yeah.
I had no nothing, you know.
No address,
no nothing. No. So then I ended up working in a butcher shop. I saved me time as a butcher over there. And
now you're about, what, 7? I mean, long are you in London then?
I'm in London now at this stage, probably about 2.5 years.
Jesus.
And then,
in those squats?
No, I moved out of squat. Right. I got a little place down in Median Road, down in Lower Clapton. East Day and things were doing all right for a while. But I was still taking a lot of drugs on the weekend.
Are you on heroin now at that stage?
No, no. Right. So I got drug psychosis. I took acid one weekend and things just went a bit, well, probably a lot wrong. And I thought that people were out to kill me, and I came out of flat and I was like, you know, and I'd see people talking, I was saying there he is. And anyway, long story short, I went down to my auntie's flat and she was there with a friend and my cousin, and I thought they were holding me there for the IRA to come and assassinate me.
Jesus.
So I held them hostage in the flat or in her house for about 3 days. And it was a horrific experience.
What did you do? Did you like tie them up or something?
No, I just held them in the kitchen with a knife, like, and told them that they weren't leaving.
And were you off
your... It was horrible because I had them peeing into a basin and everything. It was just, it was...
My God.
Yeah. And do you remember that now?
I remember bits of it, yeah.
Bits of it, yeah.
And then I got sanctioned and I got sectioned and I got put into a psychiatric intensive care unit in London for about 7 months. And
really?
Yeah, it was horrible. It was a horrible time in my life. And I never thought I'd get out of the place. I tried to take my own life. It was a really horrible time. And lots of stuff happened in there. And I was on a lot of medication. And I really thought that I was going to be left there. I thought I was going to be in London for the rest of my life in this
unit.
You're
only about 19 in there now.
Yeah, yeah, I'm 19. And eventually I get out after 7 months.
And was your mum and dad contacted her then?
My mum came to live in London at that time. She come over.
For
to,
you?
Yeah, she come over. And my mum stayed in London then after that.
Okay.
Yeah, so she stayed in London for a good few years after that when I got out. I came home and my sister looked after me. My dad was kind of drinking and that. And then when I got a bit better, I went and done the whole lot again. I ended up in another psychiatric.
Right. In
Dublin. I ended up in Dundrum. I got into a taxi, same thing again, drug psychosis.
Are you still on acid?
No, I was kind of back to normal. My sister detoxed me off the psychiatric drugs. Like it was just crazy. And then I went down.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds. And they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
I proceeded to do it all again, and I thought I owned the Dublin. I don't know how that came about. And the ILAC was getting built at the time, and I remember sitting on Henry Street and looking down at Connolly Station, and the sun was coming up, and every time I looked at the sun, I could control the sun kept going back down.
What a guy.
And then I went into the butcher's on Moore Street, and I walked in behind the counter and I started shouting the knife. And your man walks out with a tray of chops and goes, what the fuck are you doing? I said, look, I just put them in the window. I says, oh, you own Dublin. I says, oh, you own this butcher's shop. But I ended up going into Dundrum and then into Vincent's in Fairview on the Richmond Road, which
are psychiatric.
It was crazy. Yeah. Come here, crazy stuff happened down there. I was in there for Halloween, and one of the funniest things down there was the Batman film was out at the time. So they asked us all what we wanted to dress up as. So I dressed up as the Joker. And my two cousins come up, who are actually subsequently dead. The two of them died from ODs. One of them died last year, and the other fella died about 3 years ago. And they sat there for the night, just laughing.
Were they in the hospital?
No, they
the
just audience? Come up to visit. Oh. Yeah, they come up to visit. So it was like, it was crazy. Like it was like something flew over the cuckoo's nest. So then I got out of there again, and then...
So now what, you're like 20?
Yeah, so then I'm just 20 then, and then I just start getting into heroin.
Go on, Mar.
I was just going to say, Willie, so you're at this stage now, you've been in two psychiatric...
Three.
Three psychiatric...
Psychiatric, yeah. It was.
Psychiatric, well done, Willie. He's a comedian as well, just in case.
Yeah, just sort of say that.
We dwell in our misery.
So you've been in three times, and I'm... Like, when you were in there, some part of you was maintaining hope that you would get out. I mean, this would be very small at times. But did you ever have the thing, when I get out, I am going to, you know, turn my life around, or I'm going to stop doing drugs? Or was that, were you thinking like that?
Do you know what it was, Mar? I never thought that drugs would have put a problem.
Right, okay.
I could never see that. Like,
you've seen that was just like going for a drink.
Yeah, I could. All the troubles that I've had in my life and all the times I ended up in psychiatric institutions and, you know, when I started taking heroin and when I started going to prison, from that, you know, and when I started taking heroin and then I ended up homeless on the street and all these things, circumstances, I never got a moment of clarity and kind of went to myself, geez, maybe if I stop taking drugs here, the things will be kind of be okay. It wasn't like that. Yeah. It was only kind of until I was, you know, people say to you, what about rock bottoms? Like, I mean, I had loads of rock bottoms. Yeah. Like, I had bags of rock bottoms. But I think for an addict, for me, who was an addict all them years, you stop when you want to stop, when you've had enough. My using and my addiction was, it was like getting into a ring every day with Anthony Joshua and getting battered and thinking that when you get up the next morning and get in that it's going to change. Like, but right. It never changed. Yeah.
So when you first, when you went on heroin when you were about 20, that's the first time?
Yeah, I was about 20.
And like when you're,
I was running around for these guys who were selling a lot of drugs and I used to be bringing stuff from place to place and I just ended up, I used to be still kind of raving and the lads were smoking gear and I had access to a lot of heroin and I just got into it. And you know, unbeknownst, I knew the dangers of drugs and I knew what they'd done. But look, the lads found out that I was taking their drugs and there was a bit of trouble and I was left with a habit and I was with a girl. And so I was left with two habits, kind of. So she was using, I was using it. And then I started going to prison for petty stuff, you know, like shoplifting. And then I got caught with drugs and I ended up going to prison for a few months. And then there was
that terrifying then when you went into prison?
Yeah, it was. It was terrifying, but
because you're pretty young still.
Yeah, pretty young, but I knew a lot of people in there. And as I said, I wasn't one of these tough guys, I suppose. I was always kind of a humorous, kind of funny kind of fella. So that's kind of what I went with, you know. And people used to like have me around to have a bit of laugh and that, like, you know.
So was it? Like, because someone like me, I mean, like, you're just kind of just rolling off your tongue that you were in prison. But for me, it'd be like, that's the end of your life. I'd be scared.
Yeah, it would be because you were living a completely different life to the life that I was leading. But I knew with the way that I was using and the way I was living my life that there was a possibility that I was going to go to prison.
So even as frightened as I was
kind of going into prison for the first time, I'm still going, do you know what I mean? Yeah.
It's almost an expectation.
Yeah, you've got to adapt. Like, you know, it's.
Well, you seem to have an incredible capacity to adapt. Like, seriously, that is the biggest understatement I've ever made in my life.
I'm kind of like a chameleon anywhere.
But you know what's bad? Because we are talking about turn your life around, but you don't even know. You're not trying to turn your life around at all in those days.
But it's not about survival.
But what I'm saying is you're surviving and you're actually heading there without even knowing.
Do you know what? When I was living homeless, I ended up homeless on the street.
Is that more terrifying than prison?
Yeah, being homeless was terrible. My dad went to Blackpool for a weekend and I pawned the video recorder in Queen Street Pawn. So my dad came back. Came back with a load of DVDs, videos. God. Going, look, I'm after getting Roy Chubby Brown and Bernard Manning and all. He says, brilliant, I'm going to watch them. He says, no, leave them till in the morning. Because you've no fucking video recorder there. It's in the pawn. So when I come up the next day, there was just a note, leave your key, you're not welcome here anymore. My sister threw me out and,
God,
it was horrible. And so I ended up in hostels and
in
living
Dublin.
On sofas and living on the streets and it was just horrible. Then I ended up getting caught with more drugs and I went back to London. My mum was living in London. And I was using intravenously at the time as well.
When you're saying, caught with drugs, are you caught with dealing?
I was caught with drugs belonged to a fella.
Yeah.
They weren't my drugs. I'm nothing to hide. If you want my drugs, I'd say they were my drugs. They weren't. He's actually dead as well. So I ended up, I ended up going to London and in London things was all right for a while and then just I started smoking crack over there and...
Jeez.
So there was a warrant for me arrest and my partner come over and then that everything just fell apart and then I ended up homeless again in London and living in a car in London, me and my partner. And then eventually I got arrested and I got extradited home to Dublin.
Were you not in Brixton prison?
I was in Brixton prison for 6 weeks and when I come back to Dublin I wasn't using, I was clean. And I'd never been clean before, but I knew going back to Mountjoy.
So what age are you now, Willie, at that stage? Roughly.
I'm about 22.
God almighty. Yeah. Only 22.
And I'm back in prison and I'm using me groin because of no veins and I'm using me neck. Jesus. And it's fucking devastating, yeah. And I still couldn't see the problem. And then a mate of mine said to me, I ended up getting 5.5 years in prison with a review after 3.5 years with conditions that I, you know, do something about my drug habit. And as the 3.5 years is coming closer, I knew a prison officer. And I just said, and I start going to these meetings, I start going to this 12-step program because they used to give out free cigarettes. And my mate says, come on up here. It's great crack. There's a lot of fucking idiots in. So I used to go up to the fucking idiots. And then I seen some people that I used to use with that used to go to these meetings. And I kind of got, you know, I was kind of going, maybe this could work for me. But I went to the prison officer and I said to the prison officer, at this stage, I was really, really ill. And I knew if I got back out, that I was either going to end up back in prison or I was going to end up dying. I knew that for a fact. So I said, listen, I said, Mark, his name is Mr. Farrell, Mark Farrell, who, you know, listens to the podcast. You know, kind of people that I rebelled against all my life, people with authority like guards and prison officers, this prison officer. And I just says, listen, I need help. He says, what do you want to do? I says, I want to go to the medical unit, which I knew it was there. And I want to do a detox and I want to try to get into the drug-free prison. And he said, leave it with me. So I left it with him. And a few days later, he says, listen, don't say that to anyone. I'm after getting you in because it was very hard to get in, you know. So I went over and I'd done a detox for a week.
And that must be difficult, isn't it?
It was the time when Liam Lawler was locked up. He was in there. Do you remember he got locked up? Mm. Well, he was treated so differently. So when we were out, he was locked up in his cell. And when he was in his cell, we were out. Like, you know, the joys of being a politician, I suppose. Yeah. And then I went through the detox and there was 10 of us in the group that went over to the detox, and 6 of them were dead in the first 5 years when we got out. Like, I was the only one that stayed clean.
They went out and went back on drugs?
Went back using, yeah. So 6 of them died in the first 5 years, and I start going to these meetings and I got out on my review at Green Street Magistrates Court, and I start going to these meetings and I got clean, and I still go to them. I still go to meetings.
And so you were clean from that day on?
Or clean, yeah, from the 4th of April 2001.
So how old were you now?
I was 29. And 29 played a big part of my life. My cell door was 29 on B2. I was 29 when I got clean. And the house that I got a mortgage on was number 29.
Really?
And then I went in and I put €1,000 on the bonus ball for the lotto. And it was 17.
And there was a
that didn't happen. That'd be a great way to end it, wouldn't it?
And there was a fucking gambler.
No, so yeah, so I that was it. I got out of prison.
And did you start work then?
My partner was still using.
Oh,
so she was using for the first 5 years of me recovery.
Wow, that must have been.
And you were living together like that?
Yeah, it was very, very difficult.
Jesus Christ.
And then my child was born, and yeah, it was mad things.
It's like it won't leave you.
No,
at that stage.
It's. I had a lot of work to do on myself because I was damaged.
But how strong you were, really, to do that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know.
I mean, that is where your life is literally changing.
You said 5 of the people that you started.
6 of them.
6 of them were dead within 5 years of leaving. When, you know, say when you walked into that room the first day, would you have been able to say?
Do you know what? I'll tell you what happened that day. A guy from Kilmoyne come up because there was different people that used to come in. And he said, if one of you get clean out of this group, he says it's going to be a really, really successful group. And I sat there and I said to myself, as I'm sure the other 9 lads probably did, I'm going to get clean.
You see, that's it, isn't it? You know,
and that was kind of more so the turning point for me. Like I'd just been so lucky. And when I got out, I went to live with my sister. I was barred from Ballymun, which is probably a bleeding heart.
Barred from the entire Ballymun?
Yeah, I was barred from Ballymun for antisocial behaviour and drug dealing. So I had to go up in front of the council, well, the corporation as they were back then, and plead me case that I was in recovery and that they would be jeopardising my recovery if I had nowhere to live, that I was staying with my sister. And through the jigs and the reels, they let me do that. And then I was on a day programme, an aftercare recovery group that I went to. And then my partner got pregnant. So then I went to work. I worked scaffolding over in London and I went to work for this firm. And then I met Des Bishop in prison. And then when I got out of prison, after about 2 years, Des asked me to do this programme, which was about it was about me getting out of prison and embarking on the world of stand-up comedy, because he seen me at a convention that I was at for the recovery thing I do, and I was doing an auction and I was just having a bit of crack, and he goes, you know what, he says, you're very funny. So he asked me to do this, and I had to really think about it, because I knew it would have ended up on the Late Late or whatever, and I decided not to do it because I didn't want to be branded as the drug addict comedian, and I knew that they dig up stuff about me past and this, that, and you know, so I really didn't want that. So I declined. I just says to Des, look, it's not happening. And then I said, look, if you're doing nothing else, give us a shout. I says, but I can't do that, you know, because I had an employer and I had a young child, and I'd you know, it was kind of, it was probably something that could have brought me back using, in a sense.
Yeah, you're trying to get away from
all that. What clarity of thought you had in that moment? Because, I mean, it must have been like a big shiny thing.
Oh, come here. I could see, there was more good in me looking at it going, yeah, it was a great platform and a great diving board for me to do what I wanted to do in regards to comedy, but I just couldn't do it, like, you know. So when he done the Joy in the Hood thing, then he called us back when he done the Ballymun, which was the pilot one. So I done that with Eric Lawler, and
this is where Des went to like disadvantaged areas in inverted commas there, and you get people to do stand up, try and teach them stand up, wasn't it? That was what he was trying to do. You all did about
and so I done that and start kind of doing open spots in comedy clubs, and then went down to Kilkenny. For the first year where I met Jason.
For the Cat's Laughs?
Yeah, we played football. I went to see Jason up in the Kilford Arms, and he was on with Rod Gilbert and Ed Bourne, and I can't think of the other act, but it was just great. And come here, we were only starting off doing comedy, and just me and Jason kind of hit off. I have to say, and I'm not blowing smoke up Jason's arse, he was very good to us. And then that August, he says, why don't you just come over to Edinburgh? So we went over to Edinburgh that year, and it was great crack. Like, and I still go over, you know. I still go
and just
over.
To say now, because like we're so running out of time, but it doesn't matter. Is that like you got to that stage, right? You're doing a stand up. You're doing the scaffolding still, and then he goes and he does this play. Right?
Yeah. So what happened was
there was a
production
a
company called Broken Talkers. So in between all that as well, my sister passed away. She died
cancer
in 2010 at 44. That was horrible.
She was lovely though, wasn't she?
She was great. My sister crack. Susan, and then my dad died in 2016. Then my relationship ended after 22 years. So there was lots of shit that happened that I had loads of excuses to probably use, but I had the tools to know that no matter what happened, I didn't use. So these guys from Broken Talkers were doing this thing. They were getting a play together, and they went into Mountjoy over 18 months, and they were interviewing people that were doing life. And then they went into the training unit, which is the kind of place where there's no drugs, and they went to see the music teacher. And the music teacher was talking to them, and he was saying, who would you recommend, you know, for someone to do this play with? And he says, off the top of my head, he says, we used to have a fella in here, he says, and he's very, very funny. He says, he's a great singer. He says, a guy called Willie White, he says,
he's
a stand-up comedian. He says, if I was to tell you to get anyone to do it, he says, he'd be the fella to get. And he says, do you have a contact? He says, no, but he's on Facebook, he's on Twitter. So the guy is contacting me through Twitter and wanted to meet me. So I came along and he says, look, this is what we're doing. It's about mental health. It was meant to be a one-man show. So I went to do it, and it wasn't really working out, me talking into the audio to myself. So one of the guys, a guy called Gary Keegan, who's one of Broken Talkers, he stood in. So he stood in for it, and it worked a lot better with him. So I thought the script was written and all that, and it wasn't. So I was giving them my experience of stuff that happened when I was in psychiatric hospitals, and, you know, and he was an ex-victim of crime. in real life. Right. I know he was an ex-criminal, so he's kind of given his version of events and I'm giving my version of events, and they got this piece together and it was just, it was just amazing. Like, it was very, very therapeutic. It was very, very hard going. I put an awful lot of hard work into it. My partner wanted to know it. My new partner wanted to know about it. I told her nothing about it. I done the lines on my own and the whole lot, what was going on. And she came to see the play and people came to see the play. And when we put it on in the Project Arts Centre, and Jason came to see it, and it was amazing.
Sounds like a very powerful piece of work.
Yeah.
It was really, really powerful. It was really heavy.
Examination?
Called the Examination, and then we got a 4-star review out of the Irish Times. Then we went to Edinburgh for a couple of weeks, got a couple of 4-star reviews over there. Then we done the Dublin Fringe Festival, and at the Dublin Fringe Festival we got nominated for Best Production and we got nominated for Best Actor, which was me. And we went, and I genuinely wasn't expecting to win it, and I won it. And I won Best Performer.
But isn't that amazing?
600
I
people.
Actually have goose pimples down.
Yeah, but you're going from a man who was like homeless, glue,
and we
heroin prison, to stand there with an award going Best Actor.
And we won Best Production as well.
That's just
so now we're in the Irish Times Theatre Awards on the 5th of April in the National Concert Hall, where we've been shortlisted from 815 shows down to the last four for Best Production as well.
Well, look, listen, we're out of time.
Oh, unfortunately.
No, but listen.
I could listen
there's
to
going
you.
To have to be a Willie White part two.
There has to be.
Now, we couldn't talk about Turn Your Life Around. Yeah. Like, I mean, this man is amazing. Do you know what I mean?
Really,
and people just want to listen to you forever.
Yeah.
But look, Willie, thanks a million.
You're very welcome.
Now, I'd love to say I'll see you again, but I will. He's a pain in the hole. He's a great friend of mine and I have to leave and see him all the time. So, like,
thanks so much, Willie.
You're very
welcome. Definitely
Willie,
continue this.
That
to
was
be continued.
Amazing. So, look, you've been listening to me, Mar and Willie. That's Mind Your Loaf. If you've enjoyed this episode, please subscribe to that and tell your friends to subscribe as well.
And don't forget, if you or someone you know is going through a tough time, there is professional mental health support online, from counselling to support groups, all available for free for anyone in Ireland on turntome.ie.
Yes, and can honey? I just finish by saying, I and some friends of mine are starting up a group called I Pressed On, which is depression mixed up with words.
Oh.
And we're just normal people who are trying to help normal people who have mental health problems. We're going to start up a drop-in centre and just somewhere, and we're getting a minibus to collect them from their house if they're suffering with anxiety or suffering with depression.
Brilliant.
Just somewhere where they can come.
So what's the name of it there again?
I Pressed on Facebook and I Pressed on Instagram. And
is
we're just normal people helping normal people with mental health problems.
What's it called again?
I Pressed On.
Is that the ironing service?
It is, yeah. It is. We'll do your shorts for you as
well. Is
that
what the minibus is for? People collect your washing.
If you lose your remote control, we'll come round and we'll press it on.
Listen, we have to go because there's somebody else coming to the studio. I think they're doing a gardening programme.
So mind your loaves and mind yourselves.
But yeah.
Right?
Look after your old bonger banks.
Good luck.
Bye. Thank you.
Turn to Me provides professional mental health support.
Ah, Jason. Do your ad voice.
Oh yeah, I'll do the ad.
Yeah.
Okay, I'll do a proper ad thing. Okay, ready? Yeah. As a registered charity, Turn to Me provides professional mental health support online for anyone in Ireland going through a tough time. From one-to-one counselling to group and peer support, Turn to Me is accessible from any device anywhere in Ireland. If you would like to support Turn to Me, you can donate €4 by texting Turn to Me to 50300. Text costs €4. Turn to Me will receive a minimum of €3.60. Service provider like charity. Helpline 076-680-5278.
Is that you?
Yeah, that was actually me. Okay. There. You've been listening to Jason Byrne and Mar, and this is Mind Your Loaf. If you've enjoyed this episode, please subscribe and tell your friends to subscribe too.
And don't forget, if you or someone you know is going through a tough time, there is professional mental health support online, from counselling to support groups, all available for free for anyone in Ireland on turntome.ie.
Mind your loaves.
And mind yourselves.
Ah.
That's like the time I was with a girl one morning. We were taking drugs, you know, and she goes, "Look, I'm at the finding the post." She says, "Right," and she opened the post and she started sharing the money with me. She goes, "There's a tenner for you and a tenner for me." There was about 100 odd quid in it, and then she got to the back of the post and there was a photograph of her and her two kids. She was had to give me half. She goes, "Oh, sorry about that."
Give us it back.
Fucking brilliant.